Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sane, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
Greetings on the day after Election Day from the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham. I'm Jeff Tiberi. This is the WUNC Politics Podcast, here to give some insight and perspective following a day in which North Carolina and much of the country went red. There were, of course, some sprinkles of blue as well. We will discuss those, and here to help us with some analysis is Rob Christensen from the News and Observer in Raleigh, a longtime political reporter and columnist, and I would add a respected voice from people that I talk to from both sides of the aisle. Rob, thanks for spending a little time with us today.
My pleasure.
If you would, just tell me where you were last night and the first two or three or four takeaways from Election Day 2016.
Well, I was not very glamorously in the newsroom collecting material news as is coming in, both nationally and locally. So I was not out at the campaign headquarters. This is my usual place I hole up on election night. And so there was, I think, my overall reaction was it was a bit of a political revolution.
You have done this for several decades. As I chatted with people over the last few months, I said, does Donald Trump remind you of anyone? The one name I heard time and time again was George Wallace. You don't have to draw that comparison or not. I will make the note that George Wallace, of course, lost and Donald Trump won. Does last night and or Trump's candidacy remind you of anything that you've seen in your time covering politics?
No, I think Trump is unique. I think the figures that come closest would be George Wallace, who I covered, and also North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms. They both had a populist sort of following in some respects. They weren't exactly like Trump. Both appealed to white working class voters. And Helms's appeal wasn't national like Trump or Wallace. We forget that Wallace, although he came out of the South, was able to get a lot of working class votes in northern states as well. They both had very much social appeals, social conservatism, and also played on I think people's fears of social change and racial change and that sort of thing.
President-elect Donald Trump, he has no experience governing. We don't really know how he's going to govern this nation. We do know that he's going to have majorities in both the United States Senate and in the House. On the right, it seems as though a good core, a large number of his supporters are ready to declare that, you know, America will be great again. And I'm sure that wall is going up and the jobs are coming back and TPP will go away, so on and so forth. And on the left, this is, you know, the end of our country, and you know, the Supreme Court is going to go radically to the right for the next 30 years. What are you anticipating? What do you think are the most likely major pieces to come forward or repeals to take place? What are you expecting from a Trump presidency?
Well, we don't know because, well, first of all, I'll give you another parallel. As I was in Washington for the paper when Ronald Reagan was elected, defeating Jimmy Carter, and that was wasn't a shock. A lot of, we knew Reagan was probably going to win in the closing weeks, but he was an outsider and brought a whole different political point of view to Washington, and that had a lot of people very alarmed. But the difference with Reagan is Reagan had a set of convictions that you knew about, and it had governing experience so that you could look to see what he had done as California governor. And we just don't have that. First of all, Trump does not have any governing experience. And secondly, We really don't know what his ideology is. I mean, he has been all over the map. Conservatives say he's not truly one of them. He doesn't really buy into a lot of the conservative agenda, which is why a lot of the Republican thinkers disowned him during the election. He has been back and forth on various issues, taking multiple sides of stands. So we know certain things he said during the campaign, but then he has backed away from them and so forth. I think it's pretty clear that, for example, the Affordable Care Act is at risk, and there will be a major push, quite possibly successful, to repeal that, and that will leave potentially tens of millions of people without health insurance unless the Republicans can come up with some sort of alternative. And what they'll do, we just don't know at this juncture. I think there may be some effort to undo some of these treaties, environmental treaties, and perhaps the nuclear treaty with Iran. Certainly, there will be some sort of crackdown on immigration, and whether it will be the wall that he promised or not, just how far he'll go, we don't know. I mean, the president is in an influential position, but it's still an institution which he has to get laws passed through Congress and has to get approval from the Supreme Court. Right now, Congress is in Republican hands, and presumably the Supreme Court will be in Republican hands too once he gets his nominee approved. But as we saw during the primary season, it is a divided Republican Party, and so it's not necessarily a given that his program will slide just right through other branches of government, or it would slide through Congress and be approved by the Supreme Court. So there are limitations on his authority as well. So we don't know. Not only do we not know really what he's going to do, but we don't know most presidents. We pretty much knew some of the people who would man a Clinton administration. They're essentially people who came up with her and people involved in past Democratic administrations. We really don't know who would man, except for just several people, who would man a Trump administration. We know a few people, like probably Newt Gingrich will be there, and Rudy Giuliani, and a few other individuals. But by and large, except for those few, we really don't know who will be the players there. So because most of the Republican establishment did not back him. And so what does he reach out to them and help them man the thousands of positions of influence, policy positions in his administration, or is he just get the loyalists? So those are things we'll have to look at.
Rob Christensen from the Raleigh News and Observer is our guest here on the WNC Politics podcast. This was the ninth time in 10 presidential election cycles that North Carolina has gone red, the lone exception being 2008 when Barack Obama carried the state by just 14,000 votes. I want to move to the governor's race, and we're going to go back a little further in history, and I'll start with this tidbit, and you can throw it in the trash or chew on it or whatever. Since 1968, there have now been 13 elections, presidential elections. Each of them has coincided with a gubernatorial race here. In seven of those, if Roy Cooper's lead, which is less than 5,000 votes, but it appears as though Pat McCrory has a tall task to undo the lead that Roy Cooper has for the executive mansion, it will be the seventh time in those 13 elections that North Carolina voters have chosen a Republican president and a Democratic governor. Should we be surprised that took place last night? In chatting with people beforehand, very few thought we were going to see a Trump-Cooper night.
No. And North Carolina, by the way, is one of the few states that holds its gubernatorial elections on the same year as presidential. Most states have separated out those races because gubernatorial elections tend to get overwhelmed by presidential elections because they create so much attention and so forth. And particularly in the South, where Democrats, when Democrats were still controlling things but were in jeopardy, they began switching over to non-presidential years in order to protect Democratic candidates for governor. But North Carolina never did that. So North Carolina has a history of tending to vote Republican in federal races and tending to vote Democrat in state races. So prior to Governor Pat McCrory's election in 2012, we'd had 20 straight years of Democratic governors, which is the longest run of Democratic governors anywhere in the country, with the exception of Oregon and the state of Washington on the Pacific Coast. So it was pretty unusual. So why is it that you have voters voting for, say, a conservative like Jesse Helms for the U.S. Senate in the federal race, and for Ronald Reagan and George Bush, et cetera, in national races, and they're voting for Democrats like Jim Hunt and so forth, and now possibly Roy Cooper in the state race? Well, federal races tend to be more ideological, and so you get into a lot more issues that this is a very pro-military state, for example, and a gun-loving state, and this is a socially conservative state, so you get into issues like abortion and school prayer and that sort of thing. And those issues tend not to be as prominent in state races. State races tend to be have issues that have a less prominent ideological edge to them. So they're talking about, although HB2 is an exception to that rule, but they tend to be issues like improving public schools or road building or issues of that nature. And so you look, voters in North Carolina have tended to look to practical moderates, and moderates that were either Democrats or moderates that were Republicans. So a lot of them, we had Republicans that were pretty, that we've had in the past, been pretty moderate as well, who were fairly pragmatic, tied to business, tied to what a noted historian at UNC, George Tyndall, called business progressivism. That is pro-business, but forward-thinking in terms of doing things like creating a great university at the University of North Carolina and supporting a fairly expansive community college system and supporting the arts and being fairly moderate on the question of race compared to other southern states and that sort of thing. And so that's been the North Carolina model. So kind of a moderate pro-business Democrats have tended to be in power in Raleigh, while North Carolinians have voted more ideological, more conservative, and in recent decades more Republican in the federal races. And before the rise of the Republicans, they were voting for conservative Democrats and sending them to Washington. There have been exceptions to that rule. So during the Depression, when things were really bad, they were voting for Franklin Roosevelt. But by and large, they have tended to vote more conservative.
One interesting thing I just wanted to put on here, I'm going to ask you a question. You can touch on these numbers if you want. But looking at urban areas, Governor McCrory carried Wake County, Mecklenburg County, and Forsyth County 4 years ago by very small margins. Again, running as a moderate, receiving independent votes, receiving some Democratic votes. This year, Cooper has carried those areas significantly. Also of note, I think, Roy Cooper received more votes in Wake, Meck, and Forsyth County than Hillary Clinton did in those three areas, which I think speaks to turnout and enthusiasm for her as a candidate. And I'm not suggesting that that would have made up the difference, because Donald Trump won by a few hundred thousand votes here. But I did think that was interesting. Sticking with the governorship, Roy Cooper, and it, should he hold on to this, should he become the 75th governor of North Carolina, will be working with supermajorities, or working against, I guess I should say, supermajorities in both chambers of the General Assembly. What, and I believe this is unprecedented in North Carolina history, what should we expect to see? A lot from the bully pulpit from Governor Roy, if in fact Cooper takes office. Lots of vetoes. I mean, what's your read on this? This is an interesting, disposition or separation of power. And Cooper doesn't have that much power here, let's be clear.
Yes, and so North Carolina's governor has been a constitutionally weak office compared to other governors. And that's also, I have to think about that as well. So since essentially since 2010, during the Tea Party inspired election, the Republicans have really controlled things, all three branches of government here in Raleigh. So what does it mean that if, in fact, let's assume Roy Cooper hangs on to win, what does it mean that Cooper gets elected? Well, first of all, it's the first step for a Democratic comeback. It's the Democrats have a very hard time winning the legislature because of the way the legislative districts have been drawn along very partisan lines. Most of them are not competitive, so if they're going to come back, they have to come back first in these statewide elections. So this gives the governor. The governor has some powers, and he can perhaps put together coalitions. Perhaps not everybody. The Republicans may not stick together as a caucus all the time on every issue. There are splits, or urban-rural splits, and so forth. There are moderate Republicans, more conservative Republicans. So there may be some room for him to uphold a veto. And of course, the governor has lots of powers within to hand out roads and jobs and that sort of thing, and he can use that sort of thing to his advantage to help. Help his program, his legislative program through. And then in addition, I think, and this is also something to think about, is now there was a change in the North Carolina Supreme Court. And so the Supreme Court has switched from Republican control to Democratic control. And while, of course, judges should not vote lockstep and partisan in a partisan manner, it does mean that that's another possible check on Republican power, and that means that there's really two branches of government now that are in Democratic hands: the North Carolina Supreme Court, judiciary, and the executive branch, the governor, and it still means that the most powerful player in Raleigh will still be the Republican legislature. But the Democrats really have been almost powerless since 2010. And so they have mainly been observers in what's going on, or they have been protesters at moral Monday rallies, while the Republicans have taken the state from what essentially was a fairly moderate middle-of-the-road policy and made it part of what Tom Tillis, the former Speaker and now U.S. Senator, calls the conservative revolution. And so they have essentially watched from the sidelines powerlessly as this has occurred. Well, now the Democrats have two branches of government, and they have, and that to actually perhaps slow down the conservative revolution or keep it from evolving further. Plus, I think the Republicans have understood probably one of the reasons that if McCrory ends up losing, is because of HB2, and there's obviously been a tremendous amount of pushback on that issue and a national boycott, and the Republicans are hearing a lot of complaints from the business community, and they listen to the business community. So I think they'll be certainly open to various suggestions about modifying or repealing that, or in some way. And I think Cooper could take the lead, perhaps, or at least be a player in working out something there.
Your guest on the WNC Politics Podcast today is Rob Christensen from the News and Observer. I'm Jeff Tiberi. I wanted to follow up on that state Supreme Court race. You mentioned the victory by Mike Morgan, who has been a Superior Court judge in Wake County. He defeated an incumbent, Bob Edmonds, and we should note that the Republicans in the state legislature wanted to make this a retention election, make this a situation where voters would have simply given a thumb up or thumb down to the incumbent. There would have been no challenger. I believe federal courts ruled that to be unconstitutional, which set in place or set forward this race, which took place, and Morgan defeated Edmonds. The Democrat defeated the Republican. He defeated him by 348,000 votes, which last night, when we talked about the governor's race, the attorney general's race was super close. The state auditor's race was separated by like 3,000 votes. Does Mike Morgan win? And we should note there was not a D next to his name. There was not an R next to Bob Edmonds, the incumbent's name. Would Mike Morgan have won if there was a D next to his name in this election cycle?
Almost certainly not, because there were for the first time party identification on the North Carolina Appeals Court of Appeals races. There were several North Carolina Appeals Court races, which is the next level of the judiciary. And Republicans in those cases won every time. And so that certainly suggests that if there had been partisan identification in the Supreme Court race, that Judge Edmonds would probably have won.
Rob, anything else before we sign off here?
I think that the one thing that we have to look at here in this election, and I think it was the really big thing in the Trump election, and I think it, and certainly I think it was played a role in the Democratic primary, and one of the reasons Hillary Clinton struggled to win that is the decline of the white working class, and that just didn't happen, but it sort of came to the fore politically now, we live in the Triangle here, and that's doing really well. It's one of the fastest growing places in the country, and as is Charlotte, and some of the other metropolitan areas of the state are doing pretty well. But at the same time, something like 49 counties have lost population in the last 4 years, and a lot of these places that have lost population are small towns and rural areas that have had textile mills and furniture factories close, and those towns have never come back. And a lot of these people who lost their jobs, they either were out of work or the jobs they got were just simply weren't didn't pay as well as they did. So their lives are, they feel like their lives are, have been not as good as they had been. And I think that explains a lot about this presidential race, because Hillary Clinton won in the metropolitan areas, but Donald Trump won very strongly in the rural and small town areas, where his whole idea of his whole message of that on trade and immigration, and that all these factories have been gone because of bad deals and so forth, it really resonated. And, you know, and I think that really hurt McCrory, too, because McCrory, his main theme was the Carolina comeback. And so that the state had come roaring back from the recession, and things were really going well. And so things are going pretty well compared to where they were 4 years ago, but it's a very uneven recovery. And so the polling we've seen says that a lot of people really don't believe it's going well. And so there was, in large parts of the state, there was a sense that things were not going as well. And so there was just enough of that characterization of the state just didn't ring true for a lot of people. And so I think that's going to be a challenge for policymakers, whether they're here in Raleigh or in Washington, is to figure out how to help bring a lot of people back into the economic growth of this country, a lot of working class people, black and white, and I think that could be an issue that really crosses partisan lines.
All right, we'll leave it there. Rob, thank you.
Okay.
And thanks to you for listening to the latest edition of the WUNC Politics Podcast. Remember, you can subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher, among other services. And feel free to share this episode on Twitter or Facebook. We'll talk to you next week.